Let's call the Employee Benefits Committee to order, and we'll ask the council to call the roll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I call the roll this morning, again, I would like to remind everyone in attendance to please sign the attendance sheet, pass it to the person next to you, so that we have a record of those in attendance today. Also, when addressing the committee, please state your name and the organization or entity that you're representing, so that committee members have that information, and I also have that information for the minutes. Turning to the roll, Senators Dever?
Here.
Holmberg?
Here.
Kilzer?
Here.
Krebsbach?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Sorbog?
Here.
Representatives Banning?
Here.
Robbint?
Here.
Grandy?
Here.
Gugisberg?
Here.
Bowser?
Here.
Metcalf?
Here.
And Wall?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Okay. I silenced my cell phone, so I would expect the loudest thing in the room will be Stuart Savickle's bow tie. Next item on the agenda is consideration of the minutes of our last meeting. Somebody care to make a motion, or would you like council to read them? We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion's carried. Before we go to our first agenda item, Faye asked that she have a minute or two to discuss the situation with the chief investment officer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Is my mic on?
Am I good?
Now you're good.
Okay, thank you. My name is Faye Kopp. I'm the Deputy Executive Director for the Retirement and Investment Office, and I did want to take this opportunity to visit with the committee to update you on the Retirement and Investment Office, as there have been a few changes here as of late. As some of you may know, John Geisinger, who was our Executive Director and Chief Retirement Officer, did recently announce his resignation from the agency. He and his wife did decide to relocate and move back east to be with family. And while we are certainly saddened that he has chosen to leave, we certainly understand the need to be closer to a family back east. With that in mind, John's last day was May 31st. And obviously then the Estate Investment Board quickly met in May and did establish a committee to lead the search for a permanent replacement. That committee does include representation from the various groups and client groups that are represented on the Estate Investment Board. The chair is Lieutenant Governor Wrigley. State Treasurer is also on the committee, as is the State Land Commissioner, Lance Gaby, Mike Sandel from the PERS Board, and Bob Toso from the Teachers Fund for Retirement Board. As I'm sure you would understand, discussion of the job duties and the position is certainly very much in its early stages, and no timeline has specifically been identified for the replacement. The board does expect to utilize the services of an executive search firm to hire a permanent replacement, and that would be selected through a competitive bid process at a later date. Until a permanent position, or until a permanent replacement is found, the State Investment Board did name me as the interim executive director for the agency, and Darren Schultz, who will be providing you the investment update a little bit later, have named him as the interim chief investment officer. So basically taking the duties and splitting them between Darren and I during this interim period of time. Together with a very qualified and experienced Retirement and Investment Office staff, we certainly plan to have continuity in investment operations and agency operations. So I think most of you certainly know me. I've been with the Teachers Fund for Retirement Program for a number of years, 24 to be exact. And always in a retirement agency or retirement administration activities. Darren Schultz, as I mentioned, is our deputy. He's currently the deputy CIO of the agency. He came to North Dakota earlier this year, and he was formerly employed by WellPoint as their investment manager for their company's defined benefit, defined contribution, and foundation assets, and was investment manager for that funds, which totaled about $5 billion in assets, which is similar to the size of the State Investment Board. Prior to that, he was an investment consultant with Morgan Keegan Tioga Consulting, and before that, he actually spent 9 years with the Alabama Retirement System with their on their investment staff. So certainly, I think he comes to us very well qualified. Also, Connie Flanagan still continues in our agency as our fiscal and investment officer. She's been with us over 20 years. So I think from an investment perspective, from an agency perspective, we certainly have the bases covered. And we certainly would like to assure you that the staff and consultants and managers that are working with the State Investment Board will continue to provide excellent administration of both the retirement plan and State Investment Board activities. So that was my hopefully 2 to 3 minute blurb, and I'd be happy to take any questions at this time. If there aren't any, then of course we can turn it over to Darren, who knows the investment program very well from his short time here.
Looks like it's Darren's turn.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darren Schultz, and I currently serve as interim CIO within the North Dakota Retirement and Investment Office. And my goal this morning, in the time allotted, is to give the committee an overview of the State Investment Board activities, an update on performance for the TFFR and PERS plans, and provide a little overview on the investment climate. I'll start first with performance. This is a summary of our estimated performance through this March, going back to inception, 32 and three-quarter years. This highlights certainly the challenging markets we've had in recent years. Over the past year, the TFFR plan has returned a net return of 2%. Meanwhile, the PERS has returned a return of 2.88%. Our three-year number reflects really the beginning of the recovery in capital markets, which for the U.S. equity market began in March of 2009, and we have posted some fairly healthy gains since that time. As you move over the longer time periods, you know, despite these challenging markets, the long-term investment strategy of the TFFR and PERS plans remains sound. We have returned, since inception, a return of approximately 9% since the, over the past 32 and three-quarter years. Looked at another way, this is a graph which shows the growth of a dollar invested within the TFFR and PERS plans, as compared to a actuarial rate of return assumption of 8% since that period of time. You know, the a dollar has compounded at a greater rate than our assumed 8% rate of return since inception. Next, I'll move on to the TFFR and PERS asset allocations. This is a chart which was presented at the January meeting, but I would just like to kind of reiterate what the changes that have occurred within the TFFR and PERS plans. As part of asset liability studies that were initiated in 2010 and completed in 2011, some changes were made to the target allocations for the TFFR and PERS plans. TFFR and PERS formerly had different asset allocations. TFFR had formerly a higher weighting in equities overall, particularly in U.S. equities, international equities, as well as higher allocation to real estate, while PERS had a lower allocation to equities and a lower allocation to real estate. As part of the asset liability studies, new targets were adopted back in last fall, and the TFFR and PERS allocations are now similar. And at the same time that this liability study was performed, we did adopt a new asset allocation framework in which we defined asset classes in three broad categories, which are global equities, global fixed income, and global real assets. And this new framework allows us to get better transparency into the underlying risk and return drivers for each of these asset classes. And this is the PERS plan. As I mentioned, similar asset allocations.
There's some extra ones over there. Or?
Yeah, I think everybody's going over here.
I'll provide you an overview on recent state investment board activity. As I mentioned, we did adopt a new asset allocation framework within the PERS, TFFR, and among our other pension clients. Additionally, we have made some new commitments to real assets, which our goal is to provide greater diversification and potential protection from inflation. Additionally, we recently completely restructured our fixed income allocation, the goal of which is to reduce volatility in the overall portfolio. The result of this restructuring, the primary component, which I think is important, is that we eliminated an allocation to corporate bonds, which we believe has some sensitivity to the equity markets, and we felt that by eliminating that allocation to corporate bonds, we can shrink overall portfolio volatility. Next, thanks to the great efforts of Tony Flanagan, we've adopted a new portfolio monitoring process, which gives us really greater transparency in observing overall portfolio volatility. And lastly, this is a project that's currently underway. I've spent the last few months working on is comprehensive review of the plan's overall global equity structure. We're looking at alternative equity structures, which we hope to adopt this fall, initiate a complete restructuring. Next, I'll focus on the fiscal year-to-date returns through March. As you can see, the teacher's plan has returned 0.78%. PERS plan 1.95%. I'll go into a little bit greater detail in a moment, but in summary, you can see the performance of the U.S. equity market as measured by the S&P 500 returning 8.43%. And what is striking is the performance as compared to developed, international, and emerging markets. Rarely do you see a performance gap that large, but this highlights a couple of things, one of which is the strength of the U.S. dollar in recent months, as well as performance of the local markets, which have underperformed the U.S., partly due to just concerns overall about the Eurozone and the state of European banks, and also its effect on the emerging markets as well. Fixed income, as measured by the Barclays Capital Aggregate, returning 5.3%, posting modest gains. This is a what is called a periodic table of asset class returns. It's something that is generated by our consultant, Callan Associates. I put together a composite, really, of just four major benchmarks to kind of give you an idea as to the fluctuating performance of, among these different benchmarks going back over the last 10 years. The four benchmarks are the MSCI Emerging Markets Index, which is a measure of emerging markets, the Russell 3000 Index, which is a U.S. benchmark, which measures the large cap, mid, and small cap indices within the U.S. equity markets, the MSCI EAFE Index, which is a measure of developed international returns, and then finally the Barclays Aggregate, which is a fixed income benchmark of U.S. fixed income securities. The performance in the quarter ending March, we had some very strong returns coming out of the equity markets led by emerging markets. Meanwhile, bonds basically eked out just a marginal gain in the quarter. Going back over the last year, bonds certainly led the pack. The U.S. equities rights neck and neck with bonds, and then the dismal performance of the international markets is reflected there. The three-year number, you can see double-digit returns by equities. That is basically the reflecting the beginning of the recovery in U.S. equity markets. And then I'll just move over the last 10 years. Emerging markets, again, posting very strong returns. Meanwhile, the developed international U.S. equities performing in line with bonds, which is very surprising. I'll make some brief comments about the current investment climate. I put together some bullet points, which really summarize the challenges that we're encountering as investors in this macro environment. Over the last 3 years, we've seen significant strides made by the central banks to try to inject capital into the markets to stimulate demand. And the macro environment is really kind of dictating the ebbs and flows of the capital markets. And everyone is, at the moment, they're focused on developments in the Eurozone. They're focused on growth here in the U.S., which until recent weeks has been very strong, not very strong, but stronger than the other developed markets. But it has weakened a bit as of late, as reflected in labor market data. And then lastly, everyone is looking at further intervention by central banks. As an indication of that, just yesterday, the S&P 500 appreciated by 2.3% on hopes of the Fed starting another stimulus program, a carryover from the current program, which ends this June, called Operation Twist, which I'll get into in a moment. This is a chart which shows these, what I call the alphabet soup of programs that the Fed has been adopting over the last really 3 years. This is a graph that shows the performance of the S&P 500 as compared to the 10-year Treasury yield and also the Fed funds rate. When the recession hit in 2007, the Fed started a program of monetary easing. This is kind of the conventional way that the Fed in historically has tried to stimulate the economy. Post Lehman, they went towards a zero interest rate policy, where they set a Fed funds target of between 0 and 0.25%. That proved not to be enough to try to stave off economic disaster, and as a result, the Fed launched a unconventional program called quantitative easing. Since that time, we've had two rounds of quantitative easing, and most recently, a program called Operation Twist, in which the Fed has issued Treasury bills, $400 billion in Treasury bills, in an attempt to buy long-term bonds to shorten, or flatten, rather, long-term interest rates. So each time the Fed has initiated these programs, we've seen a rally in equity markets, only to see the markets fade at the end of these programs. And as of late, we've had some weakness in equity markets, and investors are really looking for more relief from the Fed. So that's maybe forthcoming. So we'll stay tuned. The question that a lot of people ask all the time is, why has this recovery been so weak? And it really boils down to one word, and that's leverage. The developed markets, over really multi-decades, have, in the private sector as well as the public sector, have been accumulating debt, and that we're kind of hitting a wall where we're in this period where both corporations and households are trying to shrink their over-indebtedness, and as a result, there's not a lot of private sector demand, and that's why the federal government has had to step in to try to stimulate growth. And this is going on not only here in the United States, but certainly in the Eurozone, with the sovereign debt crisis going on. We have, as you can see in this table, many countries that are at different stages and different levels of deleveraging. Here in the United States, households have started that process of shrinking their debt. Corporate sector is really, in the United States, is quite healthy. During the last two recessions, they have shrunk their overall indebtedness. And the banking sector, after Lehman Brothers, have shrunk their balance sheets as well. Meanwhile, the federal government has certainly raised its debt balance. In the last 4 years, the federal government has borrowed $6 trillion which you compare that to US GDP of 14 billion, it's really quite staggering. So we're really going to have to embark on a process of trying to shrink our federal indebtedness. Meanwhile, in the Eurozone, Germany is in the best health. However, Italy and Spain have really, the banking sector is in really quite a lot of distress. So that deleveraging process is really yet to occur. So this is why the recovery has been very weak. In the U.S., we've had really 5 years of deleveraging going on outside of the government sector, and there's a rule of thumb that whenever you have these balance sheet type recessions, it takes approximately 7 years to get out of this cycle. So the hopes are that maybe in the next couple of years we'll see some more private sector demand and more growth. Lastly, I just want to give the committee a update on the Westridge WG trading. The SIB has appealed the receiver's initial distribution of the WG trading Westridge assets, and oral arguments were held recently by the Second Circuit, and we're awaiting a decision on this appeal, and we'll have an update on that shortly. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments. I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Questions? I'm kind of curious, you know, the conversations that we've had in the last 3 or 4 years have to do with capitalism, free market. We've changed the paradigm. We seem to be imitating Europe. When we come out of this recession, thinking long term, do we go back to business as usual as it was before the recession? That's a difficult question.
Well, I think in corporate America, I draw a distinction between corporate America and the U.S. federal government. I think corporate America is really in very good health. The overall corporate balance sheets, corporate cash is at record levels. They are just sort of waiting for the economic environment to improve, and also there's concerns about regulations coming out of Washington. I think overall sentiment will get better, but I'm more concerned about what's going on in Washington and the gridlock and really the unwillingness to make hard decisions to try to shrink the overall federal government debt. But I feel bullish about corporate America specifically.
And I guess the gist of my question is, looking forward, you know, do we follow the same assumptions? Is 8% a valid assumption? Can we determine the future by looking at the past?
Well, I think there's a behavioral tendency to anchor forecasts based on short-term results, short-term performance, to look at the recent past as a guidepost for making long-term capital market assumptions. Whether we can achieve an 8% return in the next 3 to 5 years, I don't know. I do think it's not unreasonable to have an 8% long-term rate of return assumption based on historical and projected inflation and performance of individual asset classes. And I think, you know, our long-term results have certainly borne that out.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Sorbaugh.
Mr. Chairman, Darren, just to expand on that, define long-term to you, because you go back 25 years, we haven't reached 8%. 30, 40, I mean, how long do we continue to call long-term to keep the 8% a realistic number? You know, because you're saying we're looking short-term, well, it hasn't achieved 8% for 25 years by the numbers you had here.
Yeah,
that's getting out there quite a while.
It is. I think of long-term as 20, 30 plus years. And you know, I acknowledge that performance of the last 20 years hasn't been achieved, but, you know, I would back up and say that the rate of return assumption is, you know, it's a planning tool. It's an assumption that it's one variable in our overall plan. I mean, there's many other variables that are certainly need to be considered, but I believe that it's really not unreasonable to maintain an 8% rate of return.
I don't see any other questions, so unless Senator Nelson's about to ask one.
Well, my question deals with that, because prior to, what, 1989, we had a legal list in which we could do investments, and they did not include stocks and the equities. And so you've got those earlier things still built into the system, according to what I read off of this schedule. If we just went, since we were allowed the prudent investor rule, what numbers would we be looking at that year? And Faye, when was that, like 89? So that last number in the chart here then of, where did it go? 8.94 over the period of time we've been able to use the prudent investment rule would be right. Because that says 32.34 years.
That would be both the legal list and the prudent investment rule.
Yeah. So we need to go down to like 25 years then. Okay, so we're at 7.65, inching up, but not quite there. Okay.
Okay. Well, you're doing a good job, because I'm no less confused than when John's.
Thank you.
Thank you, Darren.
Well, I ended up at my friend's house in Valley City.
So, Faye, are you presenting the bills? Number 99? Sure.
Where'd you find it?
Is that what we have in our binder already?
Not my testimony.
Oh, this is testimony. Okay.
A car made 50 miles a gallon. Yeah. My new little Prius has 2,000 miles on it.
Would you like me to begin yet?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, my name is Faye Kopp with the Retirement and Investment Office, which is the agency that administers the Teacher's Fund for Retirement Program. I have passed out testimony relating to Bill Number 99, and I believe the bill itself was probably included in your materials. Bill Number 99 was submitted by the TFFR Board, and this bill makes a number of technical corrections and administrative changes to the TFFR program. These changes are not expected to have an actuarial effect on the plan, and they are not being submitted for funding improvement purposes. This is similar, or many of the provisions in this bill are similar to those that have been in our administrative or technical corrections bill in previous sessions, with a few changes, and I'll certainly point all of those out as we go through. But in general, the bill updates certain definitions, incorporates federal tax law changes to stay current with the federal Internal Revenue Code changes as they relate to qualified plans. The proposed amendments are intended to prevent a change in the federal Internal Revenue Code from automatically triggering a change in North Dakota law. The bill also adds a savings clause for plan modifications to ensure compliance with federal statutes or rules. I would note here that earlier this week, the Internal Revenue Service did make a favorable determination on the North Dakota Teachers Fund for Retirement Plan. This was an application we submitted nearly 2 years ago, and they have finally ruled on the plan. There was quite a backlog of applications, and we understand that based on about a month ago that backlog was beginning to be eliminated. So again, this was the second favorable determination letter we have received from the Internal Revenue Code. We do submit our plan to the IRS for plan determination status every 5 years, so we will be doing this again in a few more years. Section 1 of the bill updates the definition of actuarial equivalent to more clearly describe its use in TFFR pension calculations. Actuarial equivalent is an amount that is either calculated by the actuary or it's based on actuarial calculations provided by the actuary, which is expected to be of equal actuarial value to the benefit otherwise payable when computed based on actuarial assumptions and methods approved by the board. Now, actuarial equivalence calculations are used to determine such things as early retirement factors, optional payment factors for joint and survivor, term certain, level income, and other benefit calculations as needed. The actuarial factors themselves are described in North Dakota Administrative Code, and the assumptions and methods are described in our annual valuation report, which is presented to this committee each year and is also available on the TFFR website. So all that information is readily accessible and available to you. Section 1 in the definition section also adds the definition of normal retirement age recommended by outside tax counsel for IRS determination letter approval. When we had submitted our plan for approval, one of the things that came back a year or so ago was a recommendation that we include an actual definition of normal retirement age. And while we include what normal retirement age means actually in the body of the plan, there was nothing specifically in the definition section. So what we've basically done, and again, this is no real change to the plan, but we did include it as a definition so that normal retirement age is the age at which a member becomes eligible for monthly lifetime normal retirement benefits. As already included in section 1539 1-10. So you'll actually see all of these provisions on what normal retirement age is in 1-10. So we've just basically linked the definition to that in the body of the plan. And just kind of for your information, or as a reminder, normal retirement age for TFFR, and this is what was approved in the last legislative session and will be effective July 1, 2013, is that unreduced retirement eligibility. A member can draw unreduced retirement benefits either when they reach a minimum age and have a rule, or when they reach age 65. But that is dependent upon whether or not that member is a grandfathered Tier 1 member, a non-grandfathered Tier 1 member, or a Tier 2 member. For members in the plan that are close, that are within 10 years of retirement, they are grandfathered Tier 1 members. There's no minimum retirement age, but they can retire with unreduced benefits when they reach the rule of 85 or when they reach age 65, so long as they are also a vested member. A Tier 1 non-grandfathered member, or those members who are more than 10 years away from retirement eligibility, have a minimum retirement age of age 60, and then they can only retire at that age if they also have the rule of 90, if their age plus service equals or exceeds the rule of 90. That was passed in the last legislative session. If they do not have the rule of 90, they would have to wait to drop unreduced benefits until they reach age 65. For Tier 2 members, and those are all members who came into the plan, they're the very newest plan members. They came in effective July 1 of 2008 or after. They, too, have an unreduced retirement age or a minimum retirement age of age 60 with the rule of 90, or age 65 if they do not have the rule of 90. So that, again, remains unchanged. It's just the definition points to this particular provision in the bill. Section 1 also defines eligible retirement salary, and basically what this does, similar to bills over the last years, is it updates references to federal tax law changes in effect on August 1 of 2013. So here's where you're going to see a lot of date changes from 2011 to 2013. And this, what it basically is doing is, as Internal Revenue Code requirements, it increases the maximum annual compensation limit that can be used in benefit calculations to $250,000 in 2012. And I will note that no active TFFR member currently has a salary large enough to be affected by this limit. Okay, but that is the maximum salary that we could use in any benefit calculations per IRS. Section 2, eligibility for benefits. Again, this updates the date, updating the reference to federal tax law in 2013 to comply with IRS qualification, and it relates to minimum distribution requirements. Section 3 benefit limits. Again, very similar to previous bills you've seen. It updates the federal tax law changes to 2013, and it increases the maximum annual benefit limit. So the maximum amount that we could pay out in the plan is $200,000 per year. Again, no retiree's benefit has exceeded the annual benefit limit. And in fact, the average benefit that we pay to our retirees is right around $19,000 per year. More than two-thirds of our retirees actually draw benefits of under $21,000 per year. So again, but there is no single individual retiree that has exceeded this annual benefit limit. Section 4 relates to vesting of benefits, and this too is a change that was recommended by outside tax counsel in order to get IRS determination letter approval. It does not make any significant changes to the plan, but there is certain language that the Internal Revenue Code needs to see, and they need to see it in the exact words that they want to see it in order to maintain plan qualification. So the two things that this bill or this section does is it removes the requirement that member assessments must be paid in order to be vested. Now there's other provisions in state law that says member contributions must be paid, and employers must withhold these member contributions, and if employers don't withhold these member contributions or pay them as per the negotiated agreement, then we would be allowed to penalize the employer and withhold DPI Foundation payments. So those provisions remain intact. So the IRS is saying that you can't force the member to pay, you know, to make the payments directly to the plan. And we're saying we're already taking care of that in other provisions that are required. Also, current language in the plan provides that a Tier 1 member must earn 3 years of service credit and a Tier 2 member must earn 5 years of service credit in order to be vested. There's no change to that. What the new language does is it clarifies that in addition to the service credit requirement, when a member reaches normal retirement age, as I had described to you earlier, then they have a vested right to a retirement annuity when they reach that unreduced eligibility age or age and service credit requirement. So again, this is specific language required by the Internal Revenue. There's no operational change. Section 2 is a new section that we are proposed adding that too relates to plan modifications, and it would be a savings clause. It adds a new section which would allow the TFFR board to adopt appropriate terminology to comply with federal statutes or rules subject to approval of this committee, of the Employee Benefits Committee, if it is determined that plan provisions do not comply with applicable federal statutes or rules. Such plan modifications would be effective until the effective date of any measure that would be enacted by the legislature, which instead would provide the necessary amendments to ensure compliance with federal statutes or rules. So for example, let's say that our determination letter from the IRS came back and said, we need to have additional certain language in the plan, which is some of which I am bringing to you today. But maybe the effective date or maybe the requirement was before the legislature would meet. The board, what we would ask here is that you allow the board to adopt such language that would keep the plan in compliance, subject to your approval, to this committee's approval, until we would be able to go to the legislature to formally adopt it there. And then, you know, such plan would ensure compliance with federal statutes and rules. So this basically has come out of the additional oversights and requests by the Internal Revenue Code to make sure the plans remain in compliance so that we can get that tax savings for the plan so that we continue to be tax exempt. So Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this does conclude my testimony regarding the study bill submitted by the board. I would certainly be happy to respond to any questions about these technical corrections and administrative changes.
Questions? And that last provision, approval by the Employee Benefits Committee, if the legislature subsequently denied that, would you be able to rescind it?
Well, if whatever the legislature still allowed the plan to be in compliance with federal statutes and laws, then yes, whatever this committee would have approved or the board would have adopted would be rescinded. But if it would be the same and the legislature would approve it, then I think it would kind of take care of itself. It's just that it would be in statute as opposed to in board rules during that interim period of time. You know, we certainly don't anticipate having to use such a provision, or we have certainly never needed to in the past. Our plan would always be to bring any of these changes to the interim study committee and to the legislature to make. That would always be our intent. But the Internal Revenue Code, the federal statutes and rules, there are getting to be some changes, and we want to make sure that this plan always remains in compliance. I do believe the PERS plan has a similar provision, and you'd have to ask Barb, but I'm not sure that has ever been utilized, you know, in the past as well. So, you know, our legal counsel did recommend that we take a look at proposing such language to allow the board to adopt such rules that would be necessary, subject to your approval, and then finally approval by the legislature.
When you mentioned the limits of $250,000 and $200,000, are those IRS limits?
The Internal Revenue Code says that a qualified plan cannot pay benefits or cannot base pension calculations on any salaries or benefits that are greater than those. You know, it's not saying that a plan couldn't establish lesser limits, but the Internal Revenue Code says it can be no greater than that for our qualified plan. And those limits are raised each year. That's why I make sure I give you what the limits are each year. Last year they were $195,000 and $240,000, I believe, or $245,000. So it's been roughly in $5,000 increments, but there was a period of time where they didn't do any increases. So, you know, those are the limits. And by bringing this to you, we're not automatically adopting whatever the Internal Revenue Code does, but they're also saying you need to adopt some limits in order to be in compliance. So, and our limits, while they could be less, they can never be more than what the Internal Revenue Code requires.
Representative Grandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the federal government making regulations and changes to the plan such as this, and we really need to adopt if we're going to stay in compliance, if they were to lower the benefits or change them in a fashion that people could not receive what we were already giving them for benefits, do we plan to forego those changes with them? Because we've always adopted the policy, as far as I understand, that we wouldn't go in to a plan that we've already guaranteed or offered to somebody and change that and lower that expectation. So how are you going to, would you address that?
Senator Dever, Representative Grandy, certainly I think we would have to really evaluate what it is those federal changes were and how they apply to the plan. I mean, I know that there's any number of scenarios that would probably cause different solutions and different recommendations. So I would find it very difficult to say exactly what we would do. My thought would be we would analyze whatever those changes are, and we would have that discussion amongst the board and with this interim committee to determine how to best handle those changes. Typically, any changes that come down, there's typically time to go to the legislature. I mean, there's always a 1 or 2 or 3 year delay. At least there historically has been, and I would anticipate that should happen in the future. But if they were requiring anything that would reduce the benefits that we are paying to our plan members, we would not automatically do that, I think, without the discussion at the legislative body. Because, you know, the question would be, you know, whose regulations are you going to violate, the state or the feds? And I think that's a discussion we'd have to say, what are they, and how can we best approach this particular situation on a, you know, individual basis. Thank you.
Other questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Bill number 43. Why don't you go up to the podium so we all get an equal shot at you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Scott Lauser, District 5 out of Minot. This bill simply changes the ratio of the actuarial value of what we passed last session from 90% up to fully funded 100%. No other changes to the bill. And this is a TFFR.
Senator Nelson.
Just a question, why?
A couple of reasons. It seems logical to me. If we can get it to 90, one of the biggest issues that we heard last session was that it wouldn't be fully funded. And in testimony, I believe in the committee last January, we heard that, we have to go back and find out what the testimonies, who it came from, but would be irresponsible to not, if it's on the path to fully funding, to revert back after 90%.
Senator
Continue.
Well, at one point, we were very close to that, and it takes only one big dive in the market to drop us down a whole lot, and how many years do you think, what's the difference in time? I don't have those records with me, and I can't remember what.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I believe we've heard anywhere between 7 and 10 extra years.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. Representative Grandy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, could, Representative Lauzer, could you tell us what PERS has for their percentage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grandy, I believe it's the same at 90%.
No, it's 100.
Okay.
So we're just matching it up.
Never ask a question
Chairman?
I don't know the answer to.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Holmberg.
I wasn't on the committee that put together the current plan. Was there a give and take as far as the 90? Was the 100 discussed at the committee level? I'm assuming it went through your committee.
I don't recall that we discussed any other number than 90, but maybe in the House they did.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in history of this, and Mr. Nelson can probably follow it, but PERS came, or TFFR came in with 90, and we left it at 90, and we never discussed changing it because that was their request.
And 90 is like 30-some years away?
Mr. Chairman, I've seen anywhere between 20 and up to 30.
Okay. So at that point, that decision could be made too. Sure. Okay. Thank you. I should have asked on the first bill if there was any other testimony. Is there any other testimony on this bill? Seeing none, is there any other testimony on the first bill? Okay. Now we're up to speed. Shifting to PERS. Bill number 100.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Barb Collins. I'm the executive director of the North Dakota Public Employees Retirement System. I'll just give a minute to get the handout to you.
Thank you.
The format that you have before you, the first page just summarizes each section of the bill, and I'll walk through that with you and give you the page number. Following that is a side-by-side of the proposed bill with the change that's being made. So, you know, you can take a look at the, after the summary page, you can go and look at the bill, and you can see the section the change is made and the description of what's occurring there. So what I'll start with, though, is I'll just go over with you the summary, and I'll give you the page number in which that occurs. Bill number 100 is what we call the PERS administrative bill. And kind of like what Faye was dealing with, it deals with some administrative issues for the PERS system. As you may remember, PERS administers 6 defined benefit plans and two defined contribution plans. And so we'll talk about how these are affected as we go through here. Section 1 of the bill, of this bill, updates the federal compliance provisions for the Highway Patrol retirement plan. And every session we come to you to update these compliance provisions, and they're updated, as you can see, and that's on page 2 of the handout. And you can see there all that's occurring is the compliance date is changing from 2011 to 2013, and that automatically updates those compliance. So that's for the Highway Patrol retirement plan. In section 2 of the bill, which is on page 3 of the handout before you, All we're doing here, this is suggested by our attorney, is just to update the reference to this, this committee. You know, as it was in our bill, referred to this committee as the Committee on Public Employee Retirement Programs. The committee's actual name is Employee Benefit Programs Committee, and so we're just updating it to the current name of the committee in our statute. Section 3 of the bill, which is on page 4 of the handout before you, is we're updating a section that allows the board to utilize provider fees to fund the administration of the deferred comp program. And let me just expand a little bit on that for you. Generally, we just went out for bid this last year on our deferred comp program and 401A, or defined contribution plan. As part of that bid, we changed from our previous company, which was Fidelity, to a new company, which is TIAA CREF. TIAA CREF had 30 basis points in administrative fees in their proposal. With the, that was what they had with the relationship with the mutual fund companies. They only needed 23 basis points of those fees. So what they did in their proposal is they said then the 7 basis points of fees can come back to you as the employer to use as you need for the administration of the program. Well, what we did is we took a look at that. That program now is funded, our administrative expenses are funded out of the other programs, you know, administrative components. Well, we looked at that, when we looked at that relationship and talked with our attorney, we realized that when these 7 basis points come back, we really don't have the authority in our statute to use it to pay for administrative expenses. And so what happens to those funds now, what the board did is we're just putting them back into the employee account. But this would authorize the board to utilize those funds for administrative expenses when as a result of a bidding procedure, something like that comes up. Now, we bid this plan 2 times before. The first time, the first one that got it was VALIC, and they didn't have any arrangements like that. They used all of the funds that comes back from the mutual fund companies, and Fidelity used all of the funds. Plus, they had a fee to the members on top of that. With TIAA CREF, you can see as a result of that bid, they don't need the full amount, and they don't have any administrative fees. So, you know, the bidding process in that case really came up with a more effective plan design. And when I talk about these fees. These companies in these type of relationships, you know, they all offer, like in our defined contribution plan, if you participate, you can go out and you can pick a series of mutual funds out there that you can invest in. Those mutual fund companies have relationships with the record keepers, such as Fidelity or TIAA CREF or VALIC, where money comes back out of those mutual fund fees to the company to pay for the record keeping. And that's what we're talking about here, is that those monies come back to pay for the record keeping. They didn't need it all, so they're willing to give it back to us. So Section 3 would allow that funds to be used to offset administrative expenses. Section 4 of the bill, on page 5, there we're proposing to change the vesting requirement in the law enforcement plans. That would be a change. Right now, it is that requires 3 consecutive years of service in order to become vested. We're just talking here about changing it to 3 years of vesting, and that incidentally is on page 5, so that they wouldn't necessarily have to be consecutive. And in the other PERS plans, such as the main plan, the judges, the highway patrol, you don't have to have consecutive years, so this would just be 3. This is in the administrative bill. We don't think it will have any actuarial cost, but we'll have to see as we go forward. Also in Section 4, which is on page 7, we are proposing to eliminate what we call the level Social Security option. This is one of the options when you retire. You have a series of options that you can take. You can take a single life benefit when you retire, or you can take a couple of other options. Some options are things such as a joint and survivor benefit, where that single life option is spread over 2 lifetimes. Another one is what we call this level Social Security option. And the level Social Security option provides that a member who retires at, let's say, age 60, that they can get a higher benefit from 60 to 65, and it's actuarially figured, and then when they get to age 65, when Social Security kicks in, they get a lower benefit, and then they get their Social Security. And the idea is that it moves part of your retirement benefit forward so that when you don't have Social Security, you get a little more money, but when you get Social Security, then you get a little less money. Well, we're proposing to eliminate that option for a couple of reasons. One, we really don't have very many members that take it, less than 5% of our membership that take it. Secondly, it is a difficult thing to explain to our membership. And yes, when we explain it to them and talk to them, whether they age 60, and we say, if you're going to take this one, you're going to get a higher benefit today. But keep in mind, when you turn 65, this thing's going to drop by a half or whatever. You're going to get less. Everybody goes, yep, I understand. We got it. We get to age 65, and we cut the benefit, and we get a phone call, and, well, what's going on? My benefit went down. And then we go back, and, of course, at that time, it's difficult. And, you know, a lot of people do understand it, but, I mean, all of a sudden, you take a pretty big reduction. So that's another reason. It's one of those that's kind of difficult to counsel in a way that's retained for those years. And then we also have some other options now, like a 20-year term certain that they can take. So we're suggesting to eliminate that option. And, you know, there's another reason. I mean, if someone has to take an accelerated benefit, this is just my observation, if somebody has to take an accelerated benefit to retire at age 60, you know, when they get 68, when they get lesser of a benefit, it's not going to make it any easier, you know. So this way, you know, you could engage in a longer-term planning, maybe better. Section 5 of the bill, here again, now this, you know, I mentioned earlier in the Highway Patrol, we updated the federal compliance provisions in Section 1. Now in Section 5 of the bill, which is page 9, we're doing the same thing. We're updating the federal compliance provisions, but this is for the PERS retirement plan. So this would be the main plan, the judge's plan, the law enforcement plan, the National Guard plan. So we're updating those client compliance provisions for each of those programs. Section 7 of the bill relates to another program at PERS. As many of you know, we administer the Flex Comp program. We call it the Flex Comp program. It's a flexible benefits program. It's a program where a member can elect each year during the annual enrollment. It's available to legislators as well, where you take a reduction in your salary, and you can put some of that money into a medical spending account, or you can put it into a dependent care account. And then you can use that. It goes in there on a pre-tax basis. And then you can use that money to pay your medical, out-of-pocket medical expenses on a pre-tax basis as well. So the advantage of the program is you get to move those out-of-pocket expenses from an after-tax to a pre-tax basis. And we have about $1 million a year that goes into the medical account, and we have about $1 million a year that goes into the dependent care account. There's a third one, but that's not affected by this change here. And we have several thousand people that participate. The largest number is in the medical program. We have always processed, in order to get that money, when you put that money into your medical account, it goes into an account. We maintain the account, but you incur a medical expense. In order to get it, you have to file a claim with us. A claim is processed, and then we send you a check, and all that is what gets you through in pre-tax. We have administered that program through the state's PeopleSoft system since the early 90s. And what we're going to do is we're looking at going out to bid this year, and we're looking at moving that off of the PeopleSoft payment system and maybe using an outside vendor to do this. And why? Well, I mean, when we first started to do this, we were able to probably process those claims. They were all paper claims. Everybody was doing paper claims, and we were able to do it as fast or faster than some of the outside vendors, only because you didn't have all the mailing going back and forth. Well, the technology has now kind of passed us. We're still processing everything by paper. Outside vendors now have debit cards. You don't have to file a claim on certain things. You just get a Visa card. You go into your healthcare provider, and you have a $20 copay. You give them that Visa card. They swipe it, and it automatically pays. no claims, you don't have to file with us anymore, you don't have to do that, it's all automatic. That doesn't mean all types of paper claims are eliminated, but a lot of them are through the debit card program. The other thing is these outside vendors now, I mean, mobile apps. They're getting mobile apps. If you do have to file a claim, instead of, you know, taking a piece of paper, filling out an application, stapling it together, putting it in the mail and sending it to us, you fill out a little mobile form, you take a picture of the claim, you attach it to the thing, and off it goes. We've looked at putting it onto the PeopleSoft system. They're not capable of doing, or not ready to do that. It doesn't look like they're going to do that. We've looked at putting it on the PERSLINK system, and that's going to be $200,000-$400,000. And we're not even confident that we'd be able to. Man, that'd be all a whole development program. You know how development programs go. I mean, maybe we get there. So we're looking at this. Now, what does this all have to do with this Section 7? This Section 7 would just allow us to pay that outside vendor through the FEXCOM program through a continuing appropriation.
Would you take a question from Senator Nelson?
I just want to know, under dependent care, is that intended only for child care, or could it be used for long-term care for an elderly parent or a spouse or someone who is in a nursing home or...
It is my understanding it's only for dependents, children.
Children, okay.
But I'll double check that just to make sure.
With our aging population, that might be something. You'd be some of us, I don't have any parents yet, but I've got a spouse who's getting up there and.
Well, most all of this program, though, is subject to, this is all set up under IRS code, so they're the ones that determine the eligibility, and all what we're able to do is just follow their provisions to do it. So this Section 7 just says that the vendor, outside vendor costs, which would be about $3 to $4 per member per month, could be paid from. And incidentally, this is a the revenue from the program pays for the administration. Every time you take a elect to move money to a pre-tax basis, the state saves the FICA tax on it. That FICA tax savings is what funds this program. And then secondly, there's a use it or lose it provision in this. If you don't use it all in the year, you lose it. That also funds the administration of the program. So that's how the program is funded, and that's how this would be paid. So that's Section 7, and that's on page 10. Section 8 relates to our defined contribution plan, the 401A plan. You can see on page 10, there's an awful lot of wording on page 10, but what it in summary basically does is it just sets in statute how we're to pay these account balances should the member pass away. So it just sets out clearly how this should go if the member passes away. You know, it goes first to the spouse, or it goes to the designated rep, and what happens to them. So we have a clear guideline in statute as to how this account balance should be processed and handled when that member passes away. That says it on page 10. On page 11, you'll see there's change there on the DC plan. Again, it's to make certain that the retiree health credit for the DC plan is handled in the same manner as it is in the other retirement programs. And today, in the other retirement programs, that health credit will continue on to the member who's receiving a benefit, or if they have a joint and survivor benefit, it would continue on to the spouse. And this just replicates that for the defined contribution plan. Right now, in the defined contribution plan, a member could actually pay out a large portion of their account to a third party and keep a few dollars in the account for the surviving spouse and keep the credit, which isn't consistent. And so this just standardized that process. Section 9 on page 11, what we're doing there is just like we have in the other retirement programs, we're adding a federal compliance section to the defined contribution plan as well. When this bill was enacted, I guess we just didn't think about putting in the federal compliance provisions and making sure they're there. And so we're adding that in to this plan, and then that will probably start the same process with this plan as we have with the defined benefit. Every year, we'll be coming back to you to update the federal compliance, because that statute, incidentally, is the plan document. If we ever get audit and the federal government says, where is your compliance per processes, we don't have a clear spot to point them to now, but here we would with the addition of that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's the overview of the administrative bill. Said it relates to the the defined benefit plans that are administered by PERS, the FlexComp program, and the defined contribution plan, and the deferred, which is the 401A plan and the 457 plan.
Are there any questions? Senator Holmberg.
This might be a question that should come on one of your other bills, but are we going to have a discussion about the annual rates of return, the 8% versus what is happening in a number of states? I notice I just reviewed some notes that for the state of Oregon to be above 8%, they go back 42 years in order to hit that particular percentage, and Rhode Island just dropped their estimate from 8.25 to 7.5%. And there was an article that was really quite interesting that was shared, I believe, with all the committee members from the New York Times last month about public pensions. Part of their issue that no one likes to address is their betting on rosy rates of return, and they have been for a number of years. And as I suggested, Oregon, in order to stay within, they just keep adding years. And the public is wondering, not that many people in the public are watching carefully, but they certainly are in places like San Jose and San Diego, that are we going to have a discussion on any of the bills that the board is presenting that deal with how we project what our rates of return are going to be?
No. I'm more than happy to talk about it if you'd like now. Or
that's up to the chairman. I don't know if you saw that article that was in the New York Times. It was May something.
I probably did, but these days there's been a lot of them. I don't remember it in particular. But generally, ours is 8%, and like the discussion you had earlier and with Darren, I mean, as you look back. Over history, and we do. Let me just give you a little bit of background. Every 5 years, state law requires that the PERS board review its economic and demographic assumptions. And so, a full what we call an experience study is done. And I think the last one for the PERS plan was done about 2 years ago. As part of that review. They come in and they look at the mortality assumptions, they look at the disability assumptions, they look at this return assumption. And, they did not feel at that time that the return assumption was not valid. And so there hasn't been a change made. As you look at ours, over the last 30 years, it's been 9.68%. Over the last 25 years, it's been 7.77%. We've been pretty close. Even over the last 20 years, it's been 7.7%. Over the last 3 years, it's been 15.26%. So it's a hard thing to peg as a long-term return assumption. I can tell you, what's a little bit, I've probably been doing this a little bit long because now I got a little history I can remember back. But during the 90s, I was regularly being criticized during the 90s, not by legislative committees, but by I want to make that clear, not by any of you, but outside groups, by saying, you have an 8% return assumption. How unrealistic is that? You should have a return assumption of 10 or 11% in your plan today. And they'd say, well, look back, especially as you got to about 1999, they'd say, well, look back over the last 7-8 years. This has always been double digits. Why are you sitting with a low return assumption of 8%? And, of course, you know, at that time, we'd argue that, well, you know, if you look back over the long term, you know, 8% is non-reasonable. And, of course, you know, at that time, we were at the higher end of the trough. Today, we're at the lower end of the trough. And, yes, we can adjust it. This still is, incidentally, is the standard. If I was able to give you, and I've got it at the office, I was able to give you the, what everybody other public sector plans are, this is the predominant return. Some are, though, adjusting theirs to seven and three quarters, but that does cost. So when we talk about this recovery plan, if we were to drop our return assumption, that would increase the cost of that recovery plan.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly understand that, and we've had that discussion, but as states like Rhode Island found, their projections were that 20% of their state budget would go to underwrite their retirement programs. That's 20% of their general fund. And they made some pretty drastic changes on kind of a bipartisan approach. But of course, they were in much greater crisis than the situation that we have in North Dakota today. But at the same time, what some of these states, as I understand it, they are moving towards the model which already exists in North Dakota, which does not have COLAs, which is one of the things that really caused some of these states just to approach bankruptcy as far as their process, and we don't have COLAs. So they're moving towards what we have, but still I think the discussion at some point needs to be, is this 8% a realistic number, knowing that there's a cost to make a change? I mean, there's only so much money going in, and it's coming from someplace, either from projections that may be too rosy, or coming from the pockets of the employees or the taxpayers. That's where the money comes from.
Our next experience study will be done in about 2 to 3 years, which would, through the normal course, examine that again. But I'd like also, if I might, just make one other comment that why North Dakota is different than the other states. The COLA is exactly on point. I mean, those COLA costs add significantly to the ongoing costs of a plan, and many states had those built in as automatic based upon some outside index, like a CPI or something like that, and you don't have that. So that makes a huge difference. But there's another significant difference between North Dakota and a lot of other states, and quite honestly, it's you, this committee. You know, I talk to my counterparts. I mean, we have here in North Dakota a process that says any of these changes to the retirement plan has to come before this committee. It has to be, you said it, by April. It comes in. We get an opportunity through this committee to carefully examine the actuarial implications of all of these changes and how they will affect it. So when it goes to the legislature, the full cost of this thing is as best understood as it can be. And that's great. Nothing comes in sidetracked off the thing, you know, it's all done carefully through this committee. In other states, they don't do this. I talked to some of my counterparts, they have their legislative sessions, and all of a sudden during the session, they got 20 bills to change, you know, change a multiplier, adjust the COLA, do something with the vesting, change the calculation of salary, do this. And these things go through legislative sessions. You know better than me what the press of a session is. And they aren't carefully thought and analyzed. And all of a sudden, big changes can be made without a full cost understanding. And so you find a lot of other states have dilemmas, and these things come about because maybe their process isn't as sound as the process that you've established here to carefully consider these things.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, and one of the poster children, of course, is CalPERS in California, but a major portion of their problem was corruption.
Amen.
Buying, what were they called, placement agents,
well,
whose palms were greased, and then their recommendations were not really approved, but someone walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money. And that, I think, is one of the more... what happened was CSG brought in fiscal chairs from all the states, and they made a presentation last month on the issue of reform of pensions. And they used three examples. They used Oregon, and they use Rhode Island, and they use CalPERS. And the interesting, one of the back discussions, states like Wyoming, Idaho, were saying every state you are presenting is represented in their governance by one political party and not the other political party. And they were wondering why it wasn't, you know, they didn't have an Idaho in there or a Wyoming or something like that. But the bottom line was it was very interesting. And I do have some material that I would give to Jeff. I only have one copy because, you know, I only have one suitcase. News articles about different state things that Jeff can have and if people want to utilize them. They're very interesting what's happening as of this past month in various states. But one area of discussion is whether or not the historical 8% is a valid number to use going forward. So.
Sparg, is that 8% referenced anywhere in statute, or is that a goal and an assumption on the plans and State Investment Board?
No, it's referenced indirectly through the experience study review. You know, that's one of the variables that gets set in the experience study.
And Mr. Chairman,
there's actually some states out there, I think, that have higher than an 8 still. So, you know, it goes both ways.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to quickly add that the CSG is the one that paid our way, not the state of North Dakota. And it's not an election year for me either. But.
And I mentioned to you that I'm going to NCSL at the expense of NCSL for the same purpose. So. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we've been talking really about that 8% benchmark and what it may or may not be doing, but could you, and I know you're always sharp with these numbers, so you can rattle them probably off the top of your head, but unfunded liability in the PERS plan, percentage at 09, 2010, and current, and what does that relate to us in dollars?
This is from the last actuarial report. And when we talk about the PERS plan again, you know, there's the main plan, there's judges. And so I can give you either the main plan number or the roll-up number.
Let's just do the main plan.
The main plan number, the unfunded actuarial liability on July 1, 2011 was $680,480,000. Now, if you go back, if you would go back to unfortunately I didn't bring that table along. If you go back about 5 years or 6 years, you know, we didn't have an unfunded liability.
I recall that in 2001, by that report, we were at 104% funded.
Okay, so, you know, we were right around, and this occurred as a result of that downturn. And we'll see here in a minute when we talk about the recovery, when the market, I mean, there were two things that happened. I mean, we had a 6% loss in 2000, and that was what was called the tech market bubble, as you may remember. And that's when that occurred. And so at that point, we were still over 100%, and we made it through that fine, and we came back, and we were on our way back up. And then, of course, there was the major one, which was the almost 23% loss. And when we talk about a 23% loss of return, you go back to this 8% return assumption, you take a 23% loss, you miss your 8, you're really missing your mark by about 32%. And as you may remember, this was there was the report by Callan that we talked about, and they looked at returns for, I don't know, last 100 or 150 years, and there were only 3 years or so that were worse than what we went through this last time. And so, you know, we hope that, you know, what happened to us this time, based on those, was truly a situation that's never going to occur in our lifetimes again. You know, based on history, it's been a rare event. Not that you don't have losses. I mean, losses are a normal event. But, you know, a 23% loss was just phenomenal. So that's what it is for the main. Now I got the other smaller.
Could you give me that dollar amount again?
Yeah. $680,480,363. Now we're going to close.
What is that in a percentage of unfunded liability?
We are right now, I can give you like our percent funded status. Our percent funded status right now would be about 71, 72.
Okay.
And, you know, we'll see here in a minute how some of that, with these proposals will go. But, you know, that's that thing. We go from 100 down to that. And
any other questions?
The recovery bill, we'll talk about how.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on this bill? If not.
Mr. Chairman, Sparb and Fay, I just sent you that article, the link to that article from the New York Times.
You could report on that after the break. I see permissive language at the bottom of the agenda that says the committee may take a 15 to 20 minute break during the meeting. Let's make it 15. Let's call the committee back to order.
What version is that?
This is our bill that we sent up to the council.
They don't have it there.
What do you need? Sure. Okay, we're ready to talk about bill number 101.
For 103?
103, since it's a retirement bill.
Oh. I guess what I got here is 101.
That was that one we just went through.
I have testimony for 101 in front of me.
I thought we'd just talk about the retirement bills together since we're kind of in retirement
sure.
mode.
Okay. Bill 103, you refer to as the recovery bill. The
recovery bill, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, good morning. My name is Barb Collins with the Public Employees Retirement System. Bill number 103 is what we call our recovery bill. This applies to the retirement plans that PERS administers, as we mentioned a few minutes ago. In addition to the main the PERS plan includes the main retirement system. It includes the law enforcement plan. It includes the judge's plan. So there are several underneath PERS. We also administer the Highway Patrol retirement plan, which is a separate trust fund. And we also administer the defined contribution plan, which we call the 401A plan. This bill relates to a recovery for all of those plans. This is basically, this was reviewed last session we came to you with a four-year recovery plan for all of these systems. This last legislative session, you approved the first 2 years of that recovery plan, and which, you know, the original proposal had the recovery spread over 2012, 2013, 2014, and 2015. Last session, you looked at it and you approved the 2012 and 2013 portion of the recovery and chose to look at the 2014 and 2015, for this next session. So this bill is just the same as what was reviewed by the committee last time in terms of the 2014 and 2015 increases. I'll go through this just in terms of the section. Section 1 relates to the Highway Patrol Retirement Plan. It provides for a 1% increase in member contributions in January 1, 2014, and a 1% in January 1, 2015. Section 2 relates to the employer contribution. The recovery is shared between the employer and employee. The employee's out-of-pocket will pay half. The employer would pay half. This is, again, exactly the same as was proposed earlier. Section 2 increases the employer contribution to the Highway Patrol Plan by 1% on 2014 and 1% on 2015. Section 3 relates to temporary members in the PERS main retirement plan. Theirs increases by 2% on January 2014 and 2% in January 2015. Temporary employees can contribute, but there is no employer contribution to that. That's why they go up that amount. Section 4 relates to the PERS main plan. Contributions increased by 1% on January of 2014 and 1% on January of 2015. That's the member contribution. Section 5 is the employer contribution to the main plan. It increases by 1% on January of 2014 and 1% on January of 2015. Section 6 of the bill relates to the judge's retirement plan. For the judge's retirement plan, it increases by 1% on January of 2014 and 1% on January of 2015. And that's for both the employer and employee. Section 7 relates to the law enforcement plan. Law enforcement plan increases by 1.5% on January 2014 and 0.5% on January 2015. Section 8 relates to the law enforcement plan for BCI, which is the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. That increases by 1% on January 2014, 1% on January of 2015. Sections 9 and 10 relate to the defined contribution plan underneath PERS. For the temporary employees, just like with the main plan, their contributions would increase by 2% on 2014 and 2% on 2015. And on Section 10, increases the employee and employer contributions to the defined contribution plan by 1% each on 2014 and 2015. Going on to page 2, of this, we'll just review with you the challenge that the plan, this is what we shared with you last session. We'll be updating these tables for you when we go study this bill and bring the results to you. But this was the challenge that we faced. Senate Bill 2108 last session addressed it. As you can see, the long term across the bottom here is 2010 going out to 2014, years going out. Across the side going up is the funded status of the plan going from 0 up to 110%. Funded status just merely means it's each year we do an actuarial report, just what we were talking about a minute ago. In that actuarial report, we compare the accrued benefits that have been earned to the assets in the plan. So if there's been $10 in benefits earned over that that are in the plan and we have $10 in assets, we are perfectly 100% funded, just where we want to be. If we have $12 in assets and we have $10 worth of accrued earning benefits in the plan, we're 120% funded, and that's even better. That's where we were back in the 90s. If we had $8, let's say kind of where we're at today, we have $7 in assets and we have $10 worth of accrued benefits, then we're 70% funded. So this just measures that funding status. So given that downturn that we incurred last time and looked ahead on these three plans, we projected, the actuary projected what was going to happen to that funded status. This was based on the 8.12% contributions at the time. You could see the red was the main plan, the blue was the Highway Patrol, and the green was the judges. You could see the funded status of the plan over the next 30 years was projected on the main plan, which is our largest plan, was projected to deteriorate to zero. So approaching this last session, and when we came to the committee, this committee last time, we acknowledged that challenge with you and indicated that the goal that we had was to reverse that funding trend, to stabilize the plan, and to establish a positive trend going forward. Those were the three things that we set for all of these plans. And we'll talk about the DC plan in a minute. So on page four of this, you can see this last time, the red line, that was the challenge that we faced. The bill that we put in last session was Senate Bill 2108. That had the four-year recovery in it. The blue line on this shows that what would have happened if the four-year recovery had been adopted. You can see the blue line, it would have accomplished all three of the goals. The downward trend would have been stopped, the plan would have been stabilized, and we would have been put on a positive course back to 100% funded status over time. Last session, you, as I said, you approved the 2012 and the 2013 increase and deferred action on the 2014 and 2015 increases. So that's what's in this bill here before you today, the same thing, it's just the 2014 and 2015 increases. But by passing the 12 and 13 increases, the green line shows what you accomplished. You stopped the downward trend, and you basically stabilized the plan over the near term. Now we just have the last step to do, which is to put the plan back onto a positive funding course. On page five, you see the same three scenarios for the Highway Patrol plan. You can see, again, the same thing. The four-year recovery is what was needed, is the blue line. The two-year recovery is what's been adopted so far, and the red line is the challenge that they faced. Page six is the judge's plan, again. The red line was the challenge, the green line is what was adopted to date, and the blue line is the last, if this bill is passed today, we'll be on that blue line track going forward. On page seven, you can see our defined contribution plan. Our defined contribution plan faces a similar challenge as our defined benefit plans. What we did to benchmark and be able to get a perspective of that is in these two exhibits. As you can see across the bottom, on the top one is the attained age of the members in the plan. Across the side, and we benchmark them to their what they would have gotten in the DB plan in terms of benefit to see how they were faring. Each dot represents one of those members. We took their actual account balance at the time, projected it forward, annuitized it, and said, well, what would they get? You can see their challenge, many of them were getting around 60% or less of what they would have gotten in the DB plan, which just shows they were affected the same way. I mean, that's not surprising. They had the same downturn as the DB plan as well. The bottom one just does it, instead of doing it by attained age, does it by years of service. You can see here with the proposal that's before you today on page 8, you can see that by increasing the contributions of those plans, the red is the current rate at 12%, the blue is getting to 16%, and the green is 20. You can see that the increase in contributions helps those dots move up, and that they would be in a better position for retirement. They still, like all plans, have a challenge. They'd still be between 60 and 80% in terms of the benefit. But clearly, clearly they have a challenge as well. And so, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that basically is this bill. As I said, it's just the same as what was brought forward, except it's just the last 2 years of what was considered last time.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sparb, can you take me to the judge's graph, 6 of 13? And at the end of last session, we were sitting at, it says, if I'm reading this correct, at 100% or better in that fund. And all of a sudden, it dipped down after we gave increased contributions.
This graph is the graph that was prepared before. This is what you saw 2 years ago. This will have to be updated now with the new bill. So this is what we had two years ago.
Okay.
Or during the session, when we went through the session. So what you see on the run here, the red line was the challenge at that, and we're on page six, right?
Correct. Correct.
Okay, the red line is what the challenge they face. The green line is what happened with the contribution increase that was given.
Mm-hmm.
And the blue line would be with the final years of the recovery. So they're, you can see the contribution increase actually, the 2 years helped stabilize that plan.
Yeah, other than it wasn't unstable. It was already at 100% according to this graph. And all of a sudden it drops over the next 2 years while we're giving them increases. So I'm
That's because, remember
smoothing out?
Yeah, so it was rolling. What's happening is those losses were being rolled in over that period of time. And of course, you know, as we get the final, the actuarial reports this year, and we'll be able to take a look and see where they're at, and maybe some of these numbers will be adjusted based on the new actuarial information.
What is the, we're seeing currently, what, at a 2% average? Is that what you had on that first graph? Right now we're getting a 2% return?
Today? Our return this year?
The return for this year is 2%?
Yeah, I think it's a negative 2.
Negative 2?
Negative year to date. But, you know, since, keep in mind that last year we had a 21% return. So as you look at these graphs project ahead based on an 8%. So if we come in this year with a negative 2, last year and this year would be added to this graph, we'd be making on average of the 2 less 21, that's 19, we'd be above the 8% for these 2 years. So.
But on page 4 with the main plan, you said earlier that we are now at about 71 or 72% funded, and that's stronger than what this shows?
I'd have to double check. I was estimating before, but I've got the... We picked up last year. This doesn't factor in this last year's valuation because that came after. So this green line will look better when we add in last year's valuation because we got a 21% return last year.
Mm-hmm.
When we factor in this year, that's going to probably bring us back to this green line because it's going to be closer to the average.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grandy.
Doesn't matter to me which of the charts you choose to look at, but I'm still looking at the judges just because that's what I have available in front of me. But we smoothed, and that's why we dumped. But now you get the 21. Where's that 21 come in? Is that the new set of 5?
That will be factored into the 5. So, you know, you have a rolling 5 years on it. And
okay.
So that will get factored into the 5. So, you know, you'll drop 1 year off at this end and add in the 20.
What are we dropping? Do you know what percentage do we drop? What, you know, was that a negative 8 year? Was that a plus 2 year?
I'll see if I can find it here quick, but I'm not sure that I know. I don't know offhand unless I can find it here. I can't find it quickly.
Okay. And we'll see those when we see the actuary reports, I assume?
Yeah. And it's in this one here, so I can, when I find it, I can give it to you.
As part of the employees on defined contributions have the option of contributing greater amount than?
No.
No?
But they can't do it to the defined contribution plan directly. But what they can do is they can contribute to the 457 plan, which is a supplemental retirement savings program. And they can do that on a pre-tax basis. So there is a vehicle available to them. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, now that plan is placed, both of those plans are placed through TIAA CREF as our record keeper. So they can do it under the same umbrella. We have the exact same investment options in both plans, so it's not like they have to go learn a whole new way of doing it. They can just go into the add the 457 plan, they could start investing, they can use the same options, they'll be using the same record keeping going into the same format. So I mean it's much more seamless than when we used to have two providers.
So the percentages that we had before us in the last session and that you now bring back to us are the percentages that you would feel comfortable with going forward?
Yes. There hasn't been really anything that's altered that picture on the recovery plan. I mean, if we'd have had last year 21% and I was sitting here today with another 21% return, I'd probably be saying, well, we can take a closer look at these numbers, but it looks like we're going to be pretty much on point, 8 and 8, roughly. We're meeting our 8% return for the last 2 years on average, so it's a pretty static picture. And that's what we projected forward as on that static picture back 2 years ago.
Senator Sorbaugh.
Mr. Chairman, but part of the reason we only approved 2 years is we wanted to see what happened.
Yep.
What we're looking at is the exact same thing we looked at, so this doesn't provide us any information.
Exactly, and that's why when we get the new actuarial report.
That's all right, so the next one comes in July. So we really can't make any decision until we see those numbers. That was our rationale for holding off.
That's why I wanted to make clear that this is the previous numbers. Now, given what we know today, I wouldn't expect this is going to change much because, we got the 21% return. We're looking at probably a 2% loss. We're going to average out over the two-year period. These numbers assumed an 8% return. We may have a two-year average of 8.5 or 9%. They're not going to change much in that two-year period, would be my guess. But you never know until the actuarial report's done and you get the solid information from them.
Any other questions? If not, is there anyone else to testify on this bill? Otherwise, we are now ready to go to 101.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, again, good morning. My name is Barb Collins. The bill before you, Bill Number 101, in addition to our retirement program responsibilities, which we've been talking about, PERS also is responsible for the Uniform Group Insurance Program. Underneath that program, we administer the group health plan, dental plan, vision plan, long-term care plan, employee assistance program, and the life insurance plan. The bill before you today relates to the uniform group insurance program. And this bill does a couple of things, but I have to acknowledge to you, this bill will probably change a lot or will change from today to when we finally consider it in October. And the reason why, as we'll see here, is because some of it is based upon trying to bring us in compliance with the Affordable Care Act, which of course is the health care reform bill. And as you all know, the status of that is pending before the Supreme Court. And so we're not quite sure where we're at, but we do know we have to, if it maintains itself, we have to try and comply, so we're doing that. So what this bill does is a couple of things. Section 1 of the bill changes the definition of temporary employee to match that in the Affordable Care Act and sets the premium level to that in the Affordable Care Act. I'll come back to that in a minute, and we'll talk about that in a little more detail. Section 2 of the bill modifies the language for political subdivisions to allow them to set up their own health savings account instead of requiring them to join the state plan's health savings account if they elect the high deductible health insurance plan. Last session there was a bill passed that allowed us to offer to state employees a high deductible health insurance plan with a health savings account. We rolled that out. It became available to state employees this January 1. The legislation also allows us to set this up for political subdivisions beginning next biennium. We're just suggesting here that as we allow rollers out to political subdivisions, that instead of having them have their contract for the health savings account vendor through us, that they would just be able to contract directly. And why is that then? The money can go from their payroll system directly to the health savings account rather than having to go from their payroll system to us to the health savings account. And it's just a little more direct. But that's the only change there. So let's come back to this Affordable Care Act thing. And if you go on to page 2 of the handout, you'll see here on the right-hand side the definition of eligible employee and temporary employee in state statute. That's what we have today. Under the Affordable Care Act, it requires that employers have to offer health insurance to all full-time employees. They define full-time employee under the Affordable Care Act to be any employee that works on average at least 30 hours per week for a month. Now that's what we know out of the Act. What we don't know yet is that there is going to be probably some fairly extensive set of federal regulations that are going to be adopted, put into place, interpreting that act, and that hasn't been done yet. But it will probably come out later this year. We need to comply with this by January 1 of 2014, which is a ways away, and so, you know, a lot of employers aren't looking at it right now. But in our case, this next session is the only session we're going to have between now and next 2014, so we have to start taking a look at it a little bit now.
Depending, of course, on the vote next Tuesday.
Tuesday. I'm trying to think of these. Is that the Supreme Court now?
Yeah, we won't be temporary. We'll be full-time.
What we put in here is a proposal that we know is probably going to change once these things start to unfold. What the proposal is to try and bring us as minimally in compliance or in compliance to the minimum of the Act. And so what we did is we changed the definition of temporary employee in here because we allow temporary employees to participate in the plan. And we change the definition of temporary so that it matches the federal definition. So that we, in theory, would meet, offer our health insurance plan to everybody that meets that federal definition. Now, the other part of the federal definition is we can't charge those temporary employees more than 9.5% of their household income for their health insurance. So we put that in here, that we wouldn't charge a temporary employee more than 9.5% of their household income. So we seem to comply with it. But I can tell you, we shared this with some of the HR people, and the first question they asked is, well, how are we going to determine household income, and does that mean that we're going to have different payments for everybody? And, I mean, it gets really complicated in the implementation of it. And at this point, all we could say is that's just what the statute says, and we'll have to wait for the federal rules to come out, and we'll have to wait for the Supreme Court to speak to it. So that's what this bill does in terms of trying to respond to it and do it. And there is a Section 3 in here. It's not in the one before you, but there will be a Section 3 that we are proposing, which just says that this becomes effective only upon implementation. Becomes effective in January of 2014, which is when the Affordable Care Act provisions would go in place, unless something has changed. So this is what this is today, and I think it'll evolve in the months to come.
Does this then have an actuarial impact?
It probably won't have. Well, I should let the actuary talk to it. I was going to say, I'm not sure if it will have much of an actuarial impact, but it will clearly have an impact on cost impact to the state because we will potentially be expanding the pool of people who have coverage, and we will be, right now, these temporary employees pay 100% of it. underneath the Affordable Care Act, we can charge them 9.5% of their household income. So then the employer's going to have to make up that difference. So while there might not be an actuarial impact to the plan, there might be a cost impact to the employers, including the state of North Dakota, because now they got to pay for a health insurance coverage, or a part of her health insurance coverage that they're not paying for today to more people.
In the actuarial report, would that be?
We'll look into that too, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just, you know, from the actuary side, they're going to take a look at things. Are the demographics going to change in a way so that the plan is going to be maybe less healthy or healthier? And if it's less healthier as a result, then it will, you know, increase the premium base. I'm not sure that that would happen, but clearly it's going to cause more, you know, if this would pass, you as the state of North Dakota are going to pay more premium than what you're paying today, because you're going to pay for more people than what you're paying today.
Do permanent employees that work 20 hours get health insurance covered?
Only if they are in an approved, 20, on average of 20 or more hours per week. So they have to be working, you know, at least half-time for the month. But only if they are in an approved and regularly funded position. And for the state, how we interpret that is it has to be in what you would designate as an authorized FTE spot. So if you authorize a half-time FTE, for example, that half-time FTE would get benefits. But if you don't, if we have a half-time employee, but they're not in an authorized FTE, they don't get benefits. Matter of fact, we have full-time employees out there working 40 hours a week, but they're not in an authorized FTE spot, they don't get any benefits. So the key is being in a spot, authorized FTE spot that you've designated in the budget process.
Okay, any other questions?
Question.
Representative Grandy.
The part-time employee, are they receiving then, for the health care, then percentage of, so if you're only a half-time, you only receive half of that, or and they paid for the rest?
They get the full amount paid today.
Okay.
Again, if they're in that authorized FTE slot, because we have employees that are working full-time, not in it, that aren't getting any benefits, some that are working half or less than half. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's what this bill is about, and we expect that it will change as we go forward.
Okay. Is there anyone else to testify on that bill? If not, 102.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, this bill relates to the health insurance coverage or the health insurance plan, and what we call the retiree health program that is administered by PERS. Let me start with just a little bit of background while you're getting it. The retiree health program that's administered by PERS was one that was established in 1989. That program provides that people who retire underneath the PERS, the Highway Patrol, get a credit toward their health insurance of $5. Times the number of years that they were in the retirement plan. So if you had been worked for 20 years, you get a credit today of $100. That $100 underneath the law, you can use to purchase your health insurance with PERS. That's the way underneath statutes. You know, you get that amount and you can use it to purchase PERS health insurance. So that's one component of this bill. It relates to that program. The second component of this bill, it relates to what we call the pre-Medicare retiree health insurance. Underneath PERS today, the state statute allows people who retire before age 65, they can elect to stay under the PERS health insurance plan. They stay underneath that plan at their own cost, less this retiree health credit, but they can stay on it at their own cost. The cost of that plan is set in statute. Today it says that the single premium for that is 150% of the state active premium. So today it's about $600 for somebody to stay, a single person. The family plan is two times the single, which is about $1,200. So somebody who retires before 65, a family plan is $1,200. and a family plan of three is 2.5 times it, which is about $1,600 today. So you can, as a pre-Medicare retiree, you can retire, you can come on, you can stay on the PERS plan under this pre-Medicare plan that's designated in its statute. So those are the two programs that this is affecting, that pre-Medicare plan, and then secondly, that retiree health credit program. So with that background, let me just review what the bill does, and then we'll go into why it does what it does. Section 1 of the bill would close the pre-Medicare retiree health plan after December 31, 2013. So nobody else would be able to come into the pre-Medicare plan after that. Legislators would still be able to participate. Section 2 allows that health credit today, which is a retiree can use only to purchase PERS health insurance, it would make that health credit portable. You could use it to purchase not only PERS health insurance, but you could use it to purchase any health insurance, as well as our dental, vision, long-term care, or our RX plan. So it would make that portable. Section 3 just does that as well in another section. And Section 4 makes this passage of this act contingent upon passage of the Affordable Health Care Act, implementation, not passage, implementation of the Affordable Health Care Act health care reform bill. And now we'll talk a little bit about why. So going on to page 2, why are we making some of this change? Well, the PERS pre-Medicare health insurance plan was originally established many, many years ago, before I was even there. And the main reason was, and it was made available to state employees, and of course legislators can continue, and the main reason was it was to make sure that when you came out of active employment, you'd be able to get health insurance. You had guaranteed issue. You've heard that term. You'd have guaranteed issue. You'd have a guaranteed place to be able to go to get health insurance. And so, you know, that's why this has been there. The credit, the health credit, was originally tied to the PERS health insurance pre-Medicare plan to encourage broader cross-section of retirees in the program. And so that's why it was originally just limited to PERS. The other thing we now have is, since this was originally set up, and I'm sorry this gets so many things, variables going here, but the other thing that we have is several years ago, the accounting regulations were changed or added, and they said that a state needs to identify any indirect subsidies they provide to retirees. They call it OPEB regulations, other post-employment benefits. And this retiree plan that we have today, this pre-Medicare retiree plan that has pre-Medicare retirees and legislators in there, there is an indirect subsidy there. Yes, they have to pay $1,200 out of pocket. It's set in statute, though, but it's not the full actuarial cost of that plan. I mean, as expensive as $1,600 a month is in health insurance for family coverage, it doesn't cover their full cost. And the only reason why is because everybody's 55 to 65 in this plan. You got nobody young in here to to help offset these costs that people my age incur. So there's a little bit of a subsidy in here. The implicit subsidy to the state is around $52 million right now in this. We're just doing a new report. It's going to go up to about $60 million. That shows up on the financial statements as a footnote. Doesn't show up, isn't plugged right into the statement. It just shows up as a footnote. So we've got that going on. The other thing we go have on page 3 is underneath the Affordable Health Care Act, as you all know, health insurance may be, how it's accessed, may be redesigned with these health exchanges and other opportunities. And people who have an income level below 133, and I'm not an expert on this, so I'm just passing along what our consultants have told us. And some of you may know more about this than I. But under the Health Insurance Act, if you have an income level below 133% of the federal poverty level, you're eligible to go into Medicaid. And, you know, for a, let's see here if I have that quickly, I mean, a 133% for a household of one is about $14,800. I think our average retirement benefit for somebody leaving before is right around $14,000. Some of our people may be eligible to go into Medicaid as a pre-Medicare retiree. Obviously, that cost of that health insurance could be dramatically less than what we offer. They also, they can go into the individual health insurance exchanges. And if your income is above between 133% and 400% of the federal poverty law guidelines, you're going to get a subsidy. That's going to be a lot cheaper health insurance coverage probably than what we offer that's available. So the basic reason as to why we needed to offer pre-Medicare retiree health insurance changes in this new world. Our retirees can go out into these exchanges or go to Medicaid, and they can get it cheaper than we're ever going to be able to offer it. So that's why we're suggesting in this bill that we would, if this actually materializes, that we would get out of this particular line of business. We would make that health credit portable so they could use it wherever they go. And then the side benefit to that for us on the employer side is we're going to get rid of that implicit subsidy off of the financials of about $50 or $60 million. It would phase off as the last of these people would move off of the plan. Now, all of this is contingent upon the health care reform bill going through are being upheld and these things actually coming into place. But if they did, that's what this bill would provide. There would be the savings, there would be this not savings because we're not funding it, but that implicit subsidy would no longer show up on the financial statements. The health credit would become portable. That will have a cost, probably about 0.12 or 0.14. We'll see when the actuarial reports come in of employer contribution to make it portable. And then we would get out of this particular line of business. That implicit subsidy is probably about $5 per month on our active contracts on average. That would gradually fade off as well if this goes into place. So there's a lot of things here. I hope I explained it without getting too cumbersome.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grandy.
Thank you. SPARB, what percentage of early retirees or pre-med take and purchase into PERS versus?
I don't know that I can give you the percentage, but I can tell you there's about 600 or 700 people in the pre-Medicare group.
And is that why we're looking at approximately $1.4 million loss if we have everybody that takes it portable?
If on the health credit, that would be on the health credit, because if by making that health credit portable. Well, let me back up. Right now, today, in order to take that health credit, you have to take the PERS health insurance. So the assumption in that plan is that about 65 or 70% of the people will actually utilize the health credit. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was originally funded around, was about 65 or 70% of the people would actually use it. And that's because not everybody's going to want to take the PERS health insurance. Now, making it portable means that assumption has to be changed to almost 100%. And that's where you end up with the 0.14%, potentially, the 0.14% cost on the contribution to the retiree health credit program.
So, if I may.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So really, that 30 to 35% that are not following through and purchasing PERS, those dollars are equal to about $1.4 million, or is what has been funding back?
I may have misstated. It's 0.14% of contribution, not million, but 0.1.
Okay.
So today the contribution, the employer contribution to that plan is 1.14 or 1.5% into that plan. The actuarially required, well, let's go. I think I put it in the handout here. If you go to page 8 of the handout, This is from the last, the July 1, 2011 valuation for the retiree health credit program that we reviewed last meeting with you. If you go down, you can see under the 2011-2012, the actuarially recommended contribution right now to that program is 0.88%. And that should be a highlighted box. Somebody over there, it's probably hard, but this is...
Page 6. Ten, but it's page 7 in his book. You look at the little number in there.
And it says 0.88. That's the actuarially recommended contribution to it. The statutory rate today is 1.14. And based upon a real rough number that we got from the actuary to make this, to change that assumption from 60 or 70 up to 100, that's going to take 0.14 contribution. So that would be added on to the 0.88. And that would mean that that contribution requirement is going to go up to about 1.02%.
And do you have a dollar amount to attach to that then?
We'll get that for you, but I don't at this point. But in terms of will we, since it's already being contributed at 1.14, would we have to request additional dollars to do it? No. If that actuarial, preliminary actual number is correct, because it can be funded between the difference of 0.88 and 1.14.
Mr. Chairman?
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But if we're looking at currently 30 to 35% that are not taking this money, it's rolling back into the fund? Is that correct? Or where does that money go if I decide not to take it?
Originally, it was set up just with the assumption that only about 70% of the people would take it. So it was only funded originally around the idea of 70. So it was assumed that the others weren't going to be taking it anyway. But because of the way this fund has actuarially worked out over time, the contribution rate is actually lower than what was expected. And that's where that difference comes.
Okay.
Other questions?
Again, you know, the Supreme Court could speak to this in 2 weeks or before we get together again, and this may all be void.
And there could be conversation next spring, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, is there anyone else to testify on that bill? Is there any other committee discussion on any of the bills? Mm-hmm. So it's my understanding that the proper procedure is that we have a motion to take jurisdiction over all of these bills, and I would mention that the last bill had a contingent effective date. Sparb said that he would amend the other one to include that, so can we just assume that that would be included?
No. Mr. Chairman and committee members, first of all, on the effective date, I'll visit with Sparb about that. I think we took that off because we don't think it's necessary, but we can talk about that. On the other bills, I assume that, as Sparb mentioned, as we move through the interim, there'll be recommendations for changes based upon the actuarial technical comments and review of the bills, and those can be incorporated in the bill as we move forward. And then, as the chairman mentioned, we will need a motion to assume jurisdiction and to request actuarial reviews of each of the bills submitted.
Okay. So we need a motion to accept jurisdiction and refer it to actuarial review. We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? We don't need a roll call vote on that, do we?
Let's see. Last time we just did a voice vote last time.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. Is there any other business to come before this committee? Let me ask, I know that Senator Nelson had a problem getting a hotel room. I don't know if you ended up.
I ended up in Valley City. At least I didn't have to get the
yeah. If our next meeting has an agenda no longer than this one, would it be okay to start the meeting at 10 o'clock for anybody that has that challenge? Okay.
That's part of the problem. Not this committee, obviously, but I'm on a committee that they, you know, 2.5 weeks out or so, set a date.
Okay. We'll take that under consideration. We'll talk about a meeting time. Jeff and I will. Any other business? If not, meeting's adjourned.
For the committee members, each of you has a binder with the bills in it, and you can take that with you. But I would caution you that if you do take it with you, be sure to bring it back to our next meeting, or you can leave it on the table, and we will store them here for you.
I might leave this with you.
Okay.
Pens aren't that hard to come by.
No.
There you go, young man.
Okay, thank you.
The treasurer gets money. Because I don't like owing money.
No, I like being owed.
Yeah. Are you going to be here for a few minutes?
I can remind you.
You don't have a lunch or what?
I'm going to go down.
Writing with my wife. Then I'll probably come down. She's walking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
John. John, are you sticking around for a while? Or?
Thank you.